The Meaning of Geranium from The Secret Language of Plants by Andrina, read by Sam Gabriel, based on the works of J.K. Rowling. Chapter 2. The Curse of the Third Child. The man tending the kiosk in the pub, Sirius had never liked the look of him, or maybe some of the werewolves that often mingled with the clientele. Perhaps one of them recognized Remus. Sirius really didn't like the kiosk man. He was unnecessarily rude and surly and seemed to take affront at people coming to the pub to drink, rather than to buy his meager selection of newspapers and sweets. But maybe it was none of them. Maybe the Ministry had decided to send some wizards to a random town near Coventry. Maybe it was just bad luck that they came across them. Neither of them was supposed to go to the town that day. But they needed milk and eggs, and Sirius could carry them, but Remus had to go because he was the one who could figure out the Muggle money, and he had said that he was not too tired from the transformation. Did it matter? They had put on a good fight, made them work for their catch, but still, caught they were, and they hadn't wasted any time in apparating them to the front of the Ministry. They had been pushed or dragged through the doors and down a corridor and many flights of stairs. They had been shoved against every sharp corner they came across and pushed down the last few stair steps. Sirius's hands and knees were scratched and bruised from that, but he was not complaining. Every 5 heartbeats or so, there was a soft plick sound, a drop of blood falling to the floor. Remus had been weak and sleepy, as he always was after a transformation. The 3 stunning spells didn't help either. They were both tied to a chair in a dark room. It was cold, despite its small size. Sirius had goosebumps on his skin. Plick, plick, plick. There was blood running from Remus's nose. At some point, a witch in a special operator uniform had produced a handkerchief and cleaned his face a bit. But then another witch, shorter and stouter, had entered the room and conjured a long silver chain to add to Remus's restraints. The chain had sunk in the flesh and cut it open, and now there was also blood running down Remus's arms and to the floor. A slow trickle, like the passing of time. Plick, plick, plick. Sirius was the alleged mass murderer, the man who supposedly betrayed his friends and killed 12 Muggles. But one doesn't simply put a pureblood in chains. Chains are for lesser beings, half-breeds. The door opened a third time, and in came one of the wizards who had captured them, accompanied by a young man with neatly combed wavy red hair. Sirius noticed with pleasure that the first wizard was sporting multiple scratches and his robes were torn. "A bust, I'm afraid," he was saying. "Grade 5 sentient spirit, completely uninhabitable." "I'm sorry to hear that, sir," answered the, who was Sirius kidding? It was a Weasley or a Pruitt, and there were none of those left. "Nothing to do about it. Still, we have these 2 now, and the good wizards and witches of Britain will sleep more easily tonight." "Half-breeds and traitors," said the young man with a tone cold and sharp, like the surgeon's knife that removes the tumor. He wrinkled his nose as if he were repulsed by their sight. "Well, I for one can say that I'm glad they'll be taken out of the streets. Want?" he added, offering from the full-size box of chocolate wands he was carrying. "It is so easy to be dismissive of those that are tied and chained." "The minister will be pleased," answered the man. MacTaggart read the embroidery on the front of his robes, waving his hands to decline the offer of chocolate treats. "We leave them under your custody, Weasley. I'll start the arrangements to transport them back to Azkaban right away." Of course, they would not get a trial. There were some papers to be signed, and then MacTaggart left, and it was just the 2 of them and the young man. He didn't look like much, except for how he had the same look as the short, fat woman with the chains, like he wouldn't think much about hurting them. They were both tied up, which seemed a bit unnecessary. Remus was seriously injured, and Sirius had taken his fair share of jinxes. But obviously, after he had managed to break out of his bonds, chairs these days so fragile, and knocked someone over, they were not taking any more chances. So very few chances that they intended to send them straight back to Azkaban. No trial, no interrogation. No interrogation meant that they already knew everything or that they knew nothing. If they had found the boys, Sirius supposed someone would have let it slip. They were not very careful with information. He had already learned that Fudge was scared shitless for his position, and that he needed a political victory yesterday. That they had figured they might have been hiding in the haunted house, yes. And that Colin had not welcomed them. Double yes, and huzzah to Colin. If they had found the boys, Sirius kept telling himself, they would have mentioned it in an insult to Remus at the very least. He had tried to say so to Remus in one of the long moments when they were alone, but Remus had shushed him. Who knew if there was someone listening? The young Weasley looked around the room, preening like a beautiful peacock. His eyes, when he looked at them, however, were distant and detached, as if he were looking past them. "They will be back in an hour," Weasley said, blinking quickly and focusing his baby blue eyes back on them. "This time you won't be able to break out from Azkaban."
"We'll see about that,"
Sirius snarled right back. He was not giving up so easily on this life he had just started living. Remus said nothing, all his strength focused on not passing out. "No, we won't." The young Weasley sounded extremely calm. It was kind of eerie. He spoke as if his word were law more than law, as if his word were fact. How was that line again? "And the word became flesh." That's how the young man spoke, as if the mere action of uttering the words made them real. What a horrible thing that he spoke so about the prison. Sirius just... He couldn't do it again. He could not survive that place, but he could not tolerate the idea of dying in that wretched place. "You will attempt to escape on the trip to Azkaban," Weasley went on, still calm. "Or that's what they will say, at the very least. And you will arrive to the island dead." The room was taken by silence. Suddenly it felt as if the walls and even the ceiling and the floor were made of white marble. There was a faint smell of dust and rosemary, and for a second Sirius got a mad image of a mausoleum or a temple in Greece, of a woman with white eyes and a hard voice. He felt the heat of a relentless sun shining in a southern sky, a sky as blue as the young Weasley's eyes. Percy Weasley sighed. "This is not what I had planned," he muttered resignedly. "But I may as well." The Curse of the Third Child. Percy didn't have the social charm of his oldest brother, William, nor the athletic disposition of his second oldest brother, Charles. Percy was just the dull, bookish child in between the first two and the explosive happiness of the twins. That was all right. All Percy wanted in life was to experience serenity, to know true calm, to be safe in a boring, predictable life. The bane of Percy's life was uncertainty. Bill was, by far, the brightest of the Weasley children, and despite their lack of good grades, the twins were probably right behind. However, Percy was the most hard worker, and so he excelled in all his classes. He had a clearly delineated path to success, and therefore to economic stability, which would be a very nice thing to have. Any kind of stability, really, because growing up in the borough was permanent chaos. So unlike his younger brothers, Percy didn't shy away from the hardest subjects, and he took arithmancy and ancient runes as electives. He also took divination, the one and only time Percy did something outside the script. His mother and his brother Charlie thought that there was some pretty girl, or boy, because Molly was his mother and a mother knows, in that class. Bill and the twins thought maybe he wanted to take an easy subject to keep his grade average high, and possibly Percy wanted to give the impression of not being completely boring. There was a little of truth in that. It was ridiculously easy to get good grades in that class, and it gave Percy free time to focus on his other classes. This is the reason why he kept taking it to his newt levels. But the reason why he took it in the first place was that puberty came with a little something extra for Percival Weasley. It was that weird feeling that made him dislike Harry at first glance, told him the boy was trouble even though Percy felt honestly sorry for him. The same feeling behind his loathing of Dumbledore, even though everybody in the family saw him as a golden unicorn that farted diamond dust. The irrational feeling that he suddenly couldn't stand his beloved childhood pet. He thought about killing Scabbers. And that was such a strange, horrible thought to have for your pet that it gave Percy nausea. He gave it to Ron, hoping that he would keep the rats safe, and hoping that he would feel better about it, but he did not. He did not. He still wanted the rat dead and away from his brother. He gave treats to the cats whenever they chased Scabbers, and then he hated himself for it, for having these sick, twisted thoughts, because truly there was no one as despicable as him. Percy saw nothing in the tea leaves in Trelawney's class. The crystal ball remained foggy gray. But in the summer of his sixth year, just as he became an adult and the family took the trip to Egypt, Percy woke up with a clear stone and gold thought in his mind that told him, "Today, you die." It was actually a pretty horrible thought to wake up to. He was so distressed that something must have shown on his face. His mother, thinking that he was still upset about the twins' prank in the pyramid, changed the vacation plan, and they went to see the museum, like Percy wanted, instead of going to the beach. Everybody complained, well, not Bill. He wanted to visit the museum, too. And by night, the thought in Percy's head had crumbled to dust. The next day, Percy saw in a Muggle newspaper the report of a traffic accident, 16 injured on the same route they would have taken. He looked at the photo and saw, as if he had been there, the bus overturning and himself extending his right arm to keep Ginny in her seat and being thrown through the window. Percy Weasley just wanted a dull life. He had a smart older brother and a strong second brother, and he was all right with being the third and a remarkable one. He spent his first year after Hogwarts focusing on his promising professional career and drinking calming tea by the gallon, deep in denial about the sick knot in his stomach. He really, really, really didn't want to think about that. A long hour after disappearing, Harry Potter returns to the center of the maze in the third trial. It had been almost 2 years since that day in Egypt. Percy, smart, hard-working Percy, had a lot of time to think in between denying there was anything to think about. He had known about Ginny. He had known there was something wrong with her, and it was not the twins teasing or missing their parents or adapting to school. It was something else. Percy knew it, and yet he hadn't known well enough to do anything about it, other than a general worry for his little sister. He had felt something wrong the moment the Dementors came to Hogwarts, but not enough to stop his brother Ron from getting hurt, almost stabbed and his ankle twisted. And he had been right about Scabbers, dear Merlin and Morgana, he had been right, and if only Percy had followed his instincts when he turned 14 and crushed the little vermin in his fist, then everything would have been better. But he hadn't, because he wasn't sure. Because it was all a foggy feeling and a blurry image. But he had had no doubts about himself, never about himself. He knew when something bad was going to happen to him. He had known that time on the Egyptian road, but he also knew with the lesser accidents. The prank candy from Fred and George that would make him puke. The awkward fall from his broom when he accepted Oliver's invitation to fly on a windy day. Even the small burn on his tongue from a boiling hot cup of tea. The bane of Percy's life was uncertainty. So he decided to make things certain. You can't take an unbreakable vow by yourself. Vows are supposed to be done between two people, and there needs to be a third party to be the bonder. Soon Percy would have to leave Hogwarts with the Triwizard Championship delegation, but there was a little bit of time. Professor Moody turning out to be an escaped Death Eater, presumed dead, made for a very convenient distraction. Percy snuck into the castle and down the corridors to the little-known cloister in the northeast wing. It was a quiet place, seldom visited. Percy used to go study there when he felt like getting some sun and fresh air without all the noise of the other students. There were four statues of the Founding Four in the middle of the little garden, each facing a different corner. Percy went to the one of Godric Gryffindor, tall and strong and with a big mustache. The statue's right hand was holding his wand high in the air, while the left rested on the pommel of a stone sword. "I need to make an unbreakable vow to myself," Percy said to the statue, panting. "Please be so kind as to be my bonder." The statue blinked. His stone face adopted a puzzled expression. "I'm in a bit of a hurry, sir, please." The statue said nothing, but the hand holding the wand in the air lowered a little bit. His head turned sideways in confusion as Percy kneeled in front of him and clasped his wrists. Technically, unbreakable vows were to be taken between two persons, but really, as long as you had two hands, or a hand and a very flexible foot, you should be able to take one by yourself once you found a bonder. The bonder was the key element. He made a small motion with his elbow, trying to politely impress his urgency. Gryffindor kept his bemused expression and did nothing. Percy expected more from a wizard who also carried a sword.
"Excuse me, young man, what are you doing?"
asked the statue of Rowena Ravenclaw, peering from under Gryffindor's raised arm. "I need to make a vow that if anyone in my family dies, I will too within 24 hours. By then, the four statues all had abandoned their usual positions, and had turned to stare at Percy, kneeling as he was by Gryffindor's feet. Gryffindor now had his wand hand clutched protectively over his chest, like a lady who had received an indecent proposition, or as if Percy had suggested he dunk his wand in a spider nest.
"Why?"
asked the statue of Salazar Slytherin. He had a beautiful voice, young and clear, and at odds with the surly and serious image of his statue. "I'm a seer," Percy answered. "I know what will befall upon me. I need to know what will happen to them, to my family."
"I see," Slytherin nodded, approving. "That is a way to ensure it. Very ingenious."
He pursed his lips, satisfied at the loophole abuse, and chuckled to himself. At this, Gryffindor took his wand from the protective folds of his chest.
"It is a true test of valor to present your life for your family."
His voice was deep and booming, and somehow less heroic than Slytherin's mellifluous tone.
"Hold your horses, Godric, Viddy,"
interrupted Rowena Ravenclaw, putting a delicate hand over Godric's frankly well-developed biceps. The man was a hunk.
"Let's think this through. He can't be making the vow off the top of his head. Phrasing is key in these cases."
"And he would have to hold it forever, even after whatever this is," added Helga Hufflepuff. She was sitting down on the pedestal, her heels clicking against it. She looked at Percy amiably. "There's some kind of ruckus going on in there. One doesn't sacrifice his life for his family in peaceful times." "A war is starting," Percy admitted. "That's what I thought." They asked him some more questions, and Slytherin came up with the idea that the vow should specify the cause of death of the family member so that they would be protected during the war, but Percy wouldn't have to kill himself when his parents died of old age, which was obviously unavoidable and would rob him of many years. The point was to force his powers to give him the visions he needed not to die young. Ravenclaw worried about the definition of family, but Percy didn't mind much, and they agreed that it would include whoever he considered part of it, regardless of actual blood relations. It took 15 minutes of heavy discussion until Ravenclaw was satisfied with the wording, and Slytherin had exhausted all other considerations. Only then could Percy make the vow to himself, with Gryffindor as his bonder and Ravenclaw by his side, whispering in his ear the very specific and well-thought-out oath. He had to leave quickly after that, his absence about to go noticed. It wasn't until much later that night, when he was about to fall asleep in his tiny bachelor apartment in London, that the realization came of what he had done. Not the vow was all right, perfect solution, best idea he had had in ages. No, it was the fact that he had gone to the statues for their help. Because as far as Percy knew, and he had read Hogwarts A History twice, they usually didn't do that. They were just statues and had never moved. The war would be long and ugly. Percy knew you shouldn't make glorious last stands at the beginning of the war. They achieved nothing other than your death. A declaration of allegiance and undying loyalty, a flashing act of defiance, that was all very nice. And it was good for morale, no doubt, but it also painted a target on your back. And on your forehead. He would be playing the long game, and that required more subtlety. When the time came, and it would come, Percy would have to be in the right position to help his family. He had full intention of seeing them all come to the other side of the war alive. He would claw his way to a high place from which he could help them, and he would cling there with all his might. It wouldn't be easy to ascend, and once there, it wouldn't be easy to hold his position. If their enemies didn't realize, if he managed to conquer that place undetected, all the better. That meant starting his ascent before anyone thought of suspecting him. To protect his position of power in the Ministry and to rise higher still, Percy had to perform some ugly tasks. Break his mother's heart. Send that horrible letter to Ron, to the twins, to dear Ginny. His brothers would forgive him, he thought. And his mother's heart would mend itself. 2 nights after taking the vow, Percy woke from a horrible dream. There were tears on his cheeks, and his mouth was dry. All he remembered was the idea of a matched set broken, pulled apart forever. He didn't get any more sleep that night. The dream came back once a week, and every time Percy knew and didn't know what it was about. He awoke in terror, knowing that something horrible would happen. He had no doubts about what. yet it was too far away to know the details. He only had the feeling of stony dust and tears and snot in his face, and the ache in his throat from feeling his heart come up that way. 3 days before Christmas, as Percy was brushing his teeth preparing for bed, he was assaulted by the thought, dark green and red and prickly like the needles of a pine tree. I won't be alive for Christmas. He didn't go to bed. He realized that night that his decision carried some complications because he had such a ridiculously large family. How come none of the statues had asked him about that? 4 of his siblings were at Hogwarts with an insane witch, and Charlie worked with bloody dragons. And yet he always felt that Charlie was the safest of them all. Charlie was extremely likable. He had no doubt the dragons would protect him. Early the next morning he went to Gringotts. With big dark shadows under his eyes, he requested some money from his accounts, just so he could get a glimpse of Bill. He saw him through a half-closed door, laughing with Fleur Delacour in what seemed to be the break room. When he heard that Percy was there, Bill came to greet him, because Bill had always been so nice. Percy was cold and standoffish as he repeated the bullshit speech he had been giving for weeks about choosing the right people. Inside, he could melt with relief, because he saw that it was not him, it wouldn't be Bill. As he went to work, Percy saw Sturgis Podmore leaving the ministry yawning, and he was hit by the certainty that it was something to do with whatever little secret club Dumbledore was running. He did not agree with Fudge's lunacy, and he thought Umbridge was dangerous, but he shared their belief that Dumbledore had a secret army at his command. Not of students, though, that's where the ministry was wrong. That night, 2 days before Christmas and before Percy was due to die, he stayed in his office after hours. At 7 he left his desk and started his slow patrol of the building. He found his father by the entrance to the Hall of Prophecy, and Percy had to smile at the irony. He waited in the shadows, and although he could not stop the attack of the snake, he did enough to drive her away before the kill. As she left, Percy knocked a few wards with his wand, raising the alarms. Soon a few Aurors, Shacklebolt, who would have thought it, and Tonks, who was in the same year as Charlie, arrived quickly enough to save his father's life. Percy returned his Christmas present unopened, and did not go to the hospital to visit his father. He knew he was going to be all right. It would hurt his family, though. His mother, especially, would suffer. But Percy still had those dreams where the matched set was broken. He knew nothing would hurt as much as that. Out of all of them, it was the cruelest loss, a double one. He had seen his mother's premature gray hair and one of the twins which won. Even in his visions, he couldn't tell, drowning in sadness. He had started this for his family, only his family, but now Percy found himself secretly helping many other people in the understanding that every Muggle-born and half-blood he helped could make a difference in the future. He did not trust Dumbledore's order, and they had positioned themselves well enough in the ministry that they didn't need him. He didn't work with them, but he sent them a tip from time to time. He sighed as Galahad. He was pretty sure no one would get the joke. He still saw nothing on the tea leaves, and the crystal ball remained dark. But he got better. Now he looked in the mirror in the mornings, and the mirror told him things, many of which didn't have anything to do with him or his family at all. By his calculations, he had saved 8 lives already, his father's and Bill's, and that horrible day when the Death Eaters thought to try something in Gringotts, and that half-blood family of 4 and Kingsley Shacklebolt and Alistair Moody. All without the Ministry suspecting. No one suspected him. Not the Ministry, nor the Order, nor his family. No one. He was the dull, bookish Weasley. The one without a spark. No one looked beyond what they thought was his ambition to shine for once in his life by getting the approval of the Ministry of Magic. It was such a good legitimate motive, such an understandable reason. No one questioned it, even if they didn't approve of his conduct. He had started this for his family, but now Percy had the opportunity to give these 2 men not only their freedom, but their lives. Men who, Percy knew, were innocent. Despite the Ministry's assurances against Voldemort's return, somewhere in the armor department there was a file on one Peter Pettigrew, suspected Death Eater. More than one person knew of the innocence of Sirius Black, but his innocence was inconvenient. It was evidence of how badly they had handled things in the past. Remus Lupin was guilty, of course, but given the stories Percy had heard from his brothers, he thought he had been quite in the right. Percy disliked Harry for the trouble that followed him, but he thought that the kid was all right. Dreadful student all around, but a kind person. He sighed. This was not what he had planned, but since he was here, he might as well. "Honestly, I don't know what you were thinking. Going around all this time out in the open, wandless," Percy said. His voice was different now, less cold than when the other wizards were around. "It is a wonder you haven't been captured earlier." "Can't exactly enter Ollivander's with this face, can I?" answered Sirius, who, despite the gravity of the situation, could still put on one hell of a smoldering, roguish smile. No one had warned Percy that this man would be so good-looking. You would think that someone would tell him beforehand about the attractiveness of the prisoners, if only to avoid any siren ploy. "Focus, Percy." "But you have some way to sneak unnoticed, don't you?" he said. "They must have, to be able to elude arrest for so long." "I know the Ministry wanted to know if you have accessed your accounts, but Gringotts refused to share the information."
"I'm not telling you anything," Percy shrugged.
"Fair enough." He opened again the box of chocolate wands and took one, peeling a bit of the gold and silver paper before biting on the point. It was white chocolate, this one. Not his favorite, but not bad either. "Did you know that a wizard's wand is only broken if they're expelled from Hogwarts?" Percy said in wonder of the, at times, absurd wizarding laws. "There are people who have actually cast unforgivable curses, and the wands are kept intact. They used to be in the Aura office during the last war, but some years after that, they decided to move them to the Wizencomet." Percy stopped to swallow. "And ended up in a drawer in administration services." He stopped and looked at Sirius straight in the eyes. "I'm so sorry. I haven't offered you any. Would you like a wand?" The hour had passed. The squad tasked with the transport of the prisoners had arrived early, only to discover their escape from the holding cell. The alarms were ringing and there was a flurry of wizards hurriedly locking all the Ministry entrances. Sirius watched this from the other side of the street, Remus leading on his side. The hour had passed, and it was enough to get outside the Ministry and now, in a second, apparate to Diagon Alley in the safe house. The kids, well, not a kid, probably the same age James and Lily had been when they became parents, although they had been kids, too, children, all of them. He had bitten his lip and asked, "Do you have somewhere to go?" They had some ideas. Ideas that involved going right back to the haunted house and finding their children. Although they weren't about to say so. Percy was shaking his head. Each shake liberated a curl from his hair gel prison. "Next week. Next week there'll be dust and blood and the smell of leather. It's so big it's confusing. I can't really see." He pointed at Remus, who had only just stopped bleeding. Sirius had relished melting the silver chains into a puddle on the floor. His very first act with his returned wand. Percy went on. "This man is about to fall over. You need somewhere safe where he can heal and rest." Going back was right out, is what he was trying to say. Sirius knew Remus would fight it, but he also knew he wouldn't fight it for long because they had punished him particularly cruelly. In real life, it doesn't matter how driven you are. If you are hurt, you are incapacitated, and you certainly can't go fight anyone. "Do you trust Dumbledore?" Percy asked, tipping his head. A curl bounced on his forehead. Did Sirius trust Dumbledore? Dumbledore? He was the greatest wizard alive, the man who defeated Grindelwald, the only one Voldemort ever feared, and the one who was now trying to stop him. The mere mention of his name had been enough, once, for him to relinquish baby Harry and pass him to Hagrid's arms. "No," said Remus curtly. "Ah, well, no then, good man. But you probably couldn't trust his judgment. He sent Harry to those muggles." "See, I don't either, and I don't know why." Percy bit his lip and tapped his temple with his wand. "Where did you go when you couldn't trust Dumbledore?" He came up with an answer. He swore them to secrecy, which was the least they could do, no trouble. Then he told them they could use the name Galahad, if asked. That put the shadow of a smile in Remus's eye for some reason. Percy had been using that name when he helped the Order, and he thought, yes, there were those who would help them. New members who could be convinced to keep it a secret from Dumbledore. Then he cast Stupefy on the ceiling to leave the trace on his wand, and asked to get a punch and possibly a curse, too, if it wasn't too much bother. He had a reputation to maintain. "I don't know how they can repay you," Remus had said, resting part of his weight against the wall. "We don't do these things expecting payment, do we?" answered Percy before smirking. But I do have some suggestions. Keep an eye, well, both eyes, on my brothers, please. They're a handful, I know. Keep them safe.
We will.
Oh, and if you find Dawlish on your way out, I would appreciate it if you could murder him a little. I dislike him very much.
I'll do my best, vowed Sirius. He would show that Dawlish man, whoever he was.
Sirius felt terrible having to punch the poor kid in the face. He made sure the curse was one that could be removed easily and didn't hurt too much. They left, and they did not open a path of fire and smoke, spreading terror around them, mostly because of the need of stealth. Still, Sirius liked to think that they did sow a bit of chaos for later. Make it clear to everyone that Percival Weasley could not have stopped them, so he should not be blamed for their escape. No one could have prevented it. Particularly the special operator that attempted to cut their way. Sirius made a mental note to discuss it with someone, because when he transformed the man into an octopus, Sirius cackled. Cackling was never a good sign, and especially not in his family. It was Dawlish, but he shouldn't have laughed so much. It was starting to rain. Sirius linked arms with Remus, and they apparated away. The rain increased. One of those summer storms that are all thunder and intensity and really big drops, bigger than the stylized sharp raindrops of winter rain.
"Hello," Sirius said when the door swung open. "I'm the renowned murderer Sirius Black. Natural murders performed, and this is the infamous werewolf Remus Lupin. He doesn't really eat children."
And that was exactly the reaction such introduction deserved. Unfortunately, Remus was too busy trying not to pass out or vomit his intestines to handle the conversation.
"I'm terribly sorry. I wouldn't normally call without having been formally introduced to each other before, but we find ourselves in need of some urgent aiding and abetting."
"Tell them about Galahad,"
whispered Remus in a single burst of breath. Breathing hurt, speaking hurt, too. He might have a broken rib. No, he had at least one broken rib.
"Ah, yes, thank you, Mooney. A man operating under the name Galahad thought you could be of help. This has to be kept secret, even from Dumbledore."
The befuddled young man stepped aside and waved them in immediately, which didn't say anything good of his critical thinking. As soon as Remus got his wind back, he would be telling them of the importance of checking for Polyjuice and not inviting strangers inside. He would let it go for now because he couldn't think of any good reason why someone would Polyjuice as them, but it was the principle of the thing. They had to learn some caution. For now, he let himself be led to the apartment upstairs, where he feebly fought against lying down because he didn't want to bleed all over their sofa. He lost. He may or may not have passed out. The world became like a chalk picture, shaky and dusty and undefined, and Remus felt himself drifting. Well, he had been hit with 3 stunning spells. But, unlike the other time, that horrible, horrible night and the cruel morning that followed, Remus was calm. He might have been badly injured, but that was nothing compared to the agony of not knowing what had happened to your child. He didn't know what had happened to Harry specifically, but in general terms he knew he would be all right, and Draco too. Draco wasn't his child, but he was becoming something like a nephew, someone he also cared about. They hadn't been captured with them, and they were smart and brave, and they would be all right.
"I hope they eat their greens," mumbled Remus,
who had been accused multiple times by the Prophet of feeding on young hearts.
"My word, Mooney, what a mother hen you are. I'm sure they'll feel guilty enough to eat the occasional green bean, don't you fret."
"Vitamins."
And then he definitely passed out. The Evening Prophet broke the news of the second escape of Remus Lupin and Sirius Black just a few hours after they had joyously announced their arrest. The paper was obviously unsure on who to blame and what to make of it, since to exculpate Fudge's administration, they would have to paint the fugitives as really powerful wizards, and that went against their editorial line of no threats whatsoever. But to say they were harmless meant that their breakout answered for incompetency, and they had already excused too much on any given day. For this reason, the report was a disastrous and convoluted story of random details. The photo on the front page was of a shaken Percy Weasley with a bruised nose exiting the building. Some editor had decided against running the arrest photos again. Better not to give an image of exactly the kind of men who had escaped. It was certainly the kind of news the wizarding community didn't know how to take. And this was after months of Dark Lord Returns denials, undeserved ministry praise, and scandalized shock at the events in Hogwarts. People simply didn't know if this was good or bad or something to worry about. Others did. The 2 boys kneeling on the library floor, legs shaking too much to hold them, they knew to laugh and cry in relief, and perhaps they jumped in surprise when their joy magically turned on the old gramophone that hadn't been used in more than a decade, and they laughed and laughed again even if there were tears. The Hogwarts professor put the bottle of wine down, and after careful consideration vanished it altogether. He decided from now on he would give himself a period of grace before worrying because of any news. No news would be consumed fresh, not when he had obviously attached himself to these remarkable people who kept cheating destiny.
"George!"
called a voice.
"Come quickly! Something wonderful has happened!"
Two other boys, slightly older but still too young and innocent for what was to come, two boys born with mirth on their lips, dissolved in rivers of laughter and demanded to know who had thrown the punch. They kissed the hand that had hit their brother, and made a whole show over how it had been due for a very long time now. Sirius had to bite his tongue. But other than a tragic ignorance of their brother's nature, ignorance that worked to his favor in any case, the twins were very good company. They welcomed them in, fed them, helped Sirius look at Remus's wounds, and as predicted, they showed no scruples whatsoever at keeping it a secret from anyone. Yes, they had joined the Order, but the Order hadn't given them the 1,000 galleons to start their business and allow them to move out of home at the end of the course. Harry had. So, of course, Harry took precedence in their loyalties. Just as Sirius had said, it was those damned Potters with their kindness and their adopting people. Nobody tells you that when you are on an adventure or during a war, there is quite a lot of downtime. There had been a daring escape. There had been the run seeking refuge. Now there was dinner, and the less heroic, "Here, I'll show you the bathroom. Why don't we keep the extra towels?" And, "You can take my bed, we're used to sharing, it's no trouble." And just people walking around in their socks. And there is nothing as removed from the adventure ideal as someone in their socks and underwear bending down to look for the spare blankets and a toothbrush. Then came the morning, and Remus waking up and announcing his intention to go look for Harry, only to become dizzy as soon as he took two steps. There was breakfast and more giggles over Percy's misfortunes, and then there was a shop to open, and a world that kept moving. At lunchtime, Fred, probably Fred in any case, froze with a forkful of salad in midair. Sirius had no idea how Remus had done it, but he was certain that they had not been eating any kind of leafy greens before. Rather than a frown, Fred had a blank expression as if his brain couldn't be bothered to send a signal to his facial muscles, too busy with mulling over whatever he was thinking. "Mooney," he said at last, putting the fork down on his plate. The lettuce leaf fell and promptly disappeared under the small mountain of chips. "He calls you Mooney."
"For some reason, someone thought Wolfman was not a good nickname," said Sirius,
who was not feeling bitter at all that the world had not recognized his hilarity. Remus put his fork down and gave them a really tired look. He was looking tired, pale and with shadows under his eyes, but this was a different kind of tiredness altogether, not one that had to do with his beaten body.
"Yes, Mooney, because of the moon. Because he is a soppy-hearted, mushy, fluffy thing. Stop kicking me! If Wolfman is too aggressive, then you get the sentimental nickname you very well deserve, sir."
"I did not say aggressive. I said blatant to the point of criminally stupid."
"Oh, my God!"
That was George, who had just arrived at the same conclusion as his brother, through a different mental path.
"Any relation to Messrs. Mooney, Wormtail, Padfoot, and Prongs, by any chance?" asked Fred, leaning forward.
George had put his hand over his heart and awaited anxiously the answer. There were 3 seconds of silence, 3 seconds in which a legendary battle of wits unfolded, to be won by Remus.
"Yes, but I must say that there was a typo." He spoke quickly, the words running in his mouth. "It is not Padfoot, but Badfoot, you see. Sirius here had an incident to the prefix, but..."
Occasionally, friends are allowed to choke friends, so they will stop talking. The problem with going into hiding is that soon it becomes a kind of torment. The people hiding you are now burdened with keeping a secret, with hosting someone in their home and feeding them without anyone suspecting anything. It is tiring and stressful and scary, and still many people through history have done it because they understood they were saving a life. The people hiding, that's not easy either. Safety doesn't bring peace of mind. There is that constant anxiety, and that fear that you will be found or that your friend will go out and won't return. Even if you somehow manage to deal with all that, there is the hiding itself, which is too similar to imprisonment. Long hours locked in a room that you can't leave and where you can't make any noise. You are useless, sitting there and doing nothing while your friend risks their life and it eats you. Inaction is a kind of poison. As chance would have it, this would not be the case. The twins, it turned out, were great admirers of the four pranksters known as the Marauders.
I told you people called us that. He said only we used it, but obviously more people did.
As much as it pains me to say it, I will admit you were right. So, of course, Fred and George had to show them their shop once it was closed and Verity had left, and the workshop where they had manufactured most of their stuff. There was praising of past and present pranksters and admiring of their inventions and some suggestions. And then it came.
We've been thinking of making a line of safety products, explained Fred.
Because of the lost DADA teacher,
George added. People learn nothing. We know nothing. Can't protect ourselves.
I mean, we could, but we play beta.
But as curriculum goes, we can't. And other people can't, because they weren't betas. This made perfect sense. There were at least two generations that barely got any defense against the dark arts training. Remus knew this to be true.
I mean, I'm confident in ourselves. We grew up in a big family.
Mm-hmm.
The weak don't survive. But most people don't have the benefit of our upbringing.
And so they bypassed the usual gloom and existential questioning that came with hiding. A table was cleared, and they erected a partition between storeroom and workshop, so Sirius and Remus could work in there without Verity discovering them. There would be no poisonous inaction, and the secret would be no burden at all. Not when they clicked so well together.
Oh, Minerva, I was looking for you.
Dear Merlin, give me patience.
Today, as I was mending my socks, I was struck by a feeling of dread. I turned at once to the cards, Minerva. The cards were calling me to deliver you a message.
Why must this woman insist on talking to me? You saved them once from being kicked out to the streets, and now they won't leave you alone.
4 times I drew the fool from the deck.
Remarkable. I have no doubt they were calling you, Sybil.
Minerva, you must listen. The forces of chaos have come to gurgle and burble together.
If you're feeling gassy, I'm sure Madame Pomfrey can offer you something.
End of chapter 2. For the full text of this and other stories by the same author, visit the AO3 page as well as the Tumblr of author Andrina. First pass editing by Ohana. Music by Sean Johnson. If you would like to commission me to record a story, voiceover, or character, please get in touch using the contact information on my website, which is located at samgabrielvo.com. And there you can find the stories that I've read, as well as links to my Patreon page, to which I hope you will consider subscribing to support me, and my Discord server, where I record things live for your enjoyment. And finally, as always, thank you for listening.